Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Today we'll speak with Ann Ober, new to the Sustainability Department at City Hall. She'll talk about her role in overseeing the Mountain Accord, soils contamination, a possible bag ban, wood smoke, and much more.
Good morning, Lynn. Then home project guru Spike Carlson, the author of Woodworking Frequently Asked Questions and A Splintered History of Wood, former executive editor of Family Handyman magazine. He's going to talk to us about his new book, Backyard Homestead, Book of Building Projects, just in time for spring.
Yeah, spring. About that.
Spring and knee-deep powder.
That's right. And, you know, I booked him specifically to get some inspiration to do some of these things myself.
Are you going to build a bee box in your backyard?
Probably not. But actually, it's almost a curse when you hear someone like this who inspires you to a certain degree, but not quite enough to actually do the project.
How's that compost been coming?
I've been working on that for about a decade. Well, he'll be fun to talk to anyway. And then finally, very fun to talk to is Dave Barry. He's the author of the bestsellers Insane City and I'll Mature When I'm Dead. Oh, you've probably read or heard him in a variety of places. This guy is prolific with his humor and also his books and columns. He'll be joining us to talk about his new book, You Can Date Boys When You're 40. And guess what? His 14-year-old daughter really loves this new book, I'm sure.
You're 40, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I just started dating last year. All that when we return. Stay with us. This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and I'm excited to announce that the Intermountain Park City Bonanza Clinic will now be a full-time Instacare. For your ongoing medical needs, you'll see our partners at the Intermountain Park City Clinic at Round Valley. For your fractures, lacerations, and urgent care needs, come by and see us at the Bonanza Instacare, 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, when a municipality has the vision that it believes reflects the desires and characteristics of a healthy mountain community, it often guides citizens towards things like using reusable bags, not idling cars, ceasing to use wood to heat homes. But when a municipality turns all that into law, is it government overreach? Joining us to talk about these issues and more is a member of the executive team at Park City Municipal Corp. She's somewhat new to Park City Municipal. It's Ann Ober. She's joining us now in the studio. And good morning to you, Ann.
Good morning. How are you today?
Well, we're great, and we were lucky enough to just hear from you last hour, but of course we have you back for more depth and a little more
detail. Some hard questions, maybe?
Not hard questions.
I mean, like that question about government overreach.
Well, it's funny because, actually, before I ask you this question, why don't you give us your background? We know you came from Salt Lake City Corporation, and we're pretty lucky to get you. You somewhat replaced Tyler Polson as the sustainability director, but that's not all you do.
Correct. So I actually started my Utah career working for Mayor Peter Caroon in Salt Lake County. I was there for 6.5 years. And in my tenure there, I was the environmental coordinator for his administration. I then managed that team later when I became the intergovernmental affairs director. So I've done a variety of roles. I then went to Salt Lake City. I was an associate director of public works, where I was more on the sidelines on sustainability. But Vicki Bennett, who some of you may know, is their director, and I sat next to each other and would throw pencils. So I still touch those issues, and it's something I'm passionate about, and it's something that I feel like I can make a difference on. So that's a little bit of my background. I've been here for 4 months, so I'm starting to get my feet under me, but it's new.
Yeah.
Is there a theme with the places that you've worked? I mean, Peter Caroon's administration was quite progressive.
Absolutely.
For the Salt Lake Valley. Then you go to Ralph Becker's administration, and that's a progressive, although you were in public works. But again, that's a forward-thinking, progressive administration. Now you're in Park City.
Well, I've learned that I need to work on things I believe in. And that means that I work for communities I believe in. And I've done both. I worked for a congressman for a while who didn't necessarily share some of my progressive views, which was great experience, but I realized that at the end of the day, I went home a little unhappy. So This was a chance for me to start directing my career to work for great places who believe in their employees and also believe in things like the environment.
So. Right. Okay, so that is a good segue into this question of when a municipality decides it is progressive and it reflects those types of people who want to live here, and they believe that the types of people who want to live here do things like they don't idle their car and they do things that are good for the environment and they care about those things and they bring their reusable bags to the grocery store. And then all of a sudden, people ask, community members or city officials ask, let's make this an ordinance. A lot of communities speak back and say, this is government overreach. These are things we ought to choose to do because we believe in it. What do you think about that?
Well, the really great thing with an elected council is that they represent this community and they are making these decisions because they believe that the constituency wants them to push in this direction. And if the community doesn't want it, they're very receptive to that push and they will step back from making decisions that the community is not attuned to. It's one of the benefits of our form of government. And I think it's an important thing to remember. It's hard sometimes with employees in a government organization who get frustrated by quote-unquote politics. But politics really are about the community telling you where they want to be. And the individuals who are chosen by those individuals saying, we're going to represent our community. So I think that it's a really good balance. And is it overreach? I don't think so. I think that it's overreach if the community doesn't stand behind you. If the community stands behind you and that's why you're making these changes, then it's the community making a decision about where they want to go as a whole.
Mm-hmm. You know what I find interesting? I don't know how it translates to staff, but because you're executing things that have been decided on in this vision that comes down from the community, that vision that comes down from the community is not always as clear as it seems when it reaches staff implementation. And that's a difficult thing to get around because even all these issues we have right now, like the Kimball Art Center, you're going to have certain members of the community that think it's great. And you're going to have certain members of the community, well-respected on both sides, well-presented arguments and critically thought out that are pro and against. And, you know, I found that all through the campaign where I go to pockets of neighborhoods and be really kind of surprised when I was walking door to door. How does that translate to where you are staff implementing the vision of the community?
So I have two examples. And in one example, you have a decision that's been made by council. Staff has chosen to implement it in its own way. An example that I can give is we wanted to do renewable energy for Salt Lake County. The council was a little hesitant but open. The staff went back and said, we want to do a goal of 10 megawatts of solar in our valley. How do we get there? And so we came up with a vision. We came up with projects. We came up with money. We came up with all the pieces. We had to go back to council and say, are we still going in the direction, even if you didn't give me a solid foundation, is this really where you want to go? And they said yes. We then implemented the Salt Palace installation. Salt Lake City has now implemented several installations. And that number is growing to the point that we will probably hit our 10 megawatts down there in the next couple of years. On the flip side, on Mountain Accord, as we're talking about this, there was a community visioning process 5 years ago. The council sets vision every year, if not every day. And we're going to come back to council and say, here's what we heard in that community visioning process. Here's what we've heard from you recently. We need some exacts. We need to know what things are required, what things are we able to have some wiggle room on, and what things do you not even need to talk about. And so I think it's that constant balance. But if you hire great staff, which I believe Park City has, we have a phenomenal team of people, everybody from Diane to the bus driver. Every single person is really a high class, you know, a high intense, wonderful employee. And so we trust them. And in some cases, you just let them run.
That's a really great answer. And, you know, again, it still brings up certain contradictions that there are. I was thinking as you were speaking about water conservation, for example, and trying to get residents to sign on to those smart water meters and then knowing how much it costs for the city to implement that. Meanwhile, certain elements of the community, golf courses, the school district are, you know, in my opinion, way over watering their you know, lawns. And so I've heard residents say, well, why should we? I mean, I'm such a tiny, teeny little user of water compared to golf courses and the schools and parks. Why should I conserve? And so when it comes down to really finding out numbers, specific numbers, do you find that people who have these ideals of living in a sustainable community, progressive community, they then abandon those? They no longer want that.
Because they don't want to pay for it, mm-hmm. Higher taxes and all those sort of things.
It's always a balance, right? I have done sustainability for 8 years. I do not have solar panels on my house. I personally have these thoughts and these processes for myself every day. Mm-hmm. My family has to balance what we are going to pay for and what we're not. I carry reusable garbage bag, grocery bags to the store every day. I recycle as much as I possibly can, but I also have a baby, and babies use a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I try and minimize where I can. I try and maximize where I can. And then I accept that I'm a human being, and in the culture we live in, there's only certain things that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So, Anne, back to you and what's going on in City Hall. How do you describe your position? I mean, you come up and you're a member of the sustainability team, but you seem to be working on a lot of different and maybe even disparate projects. Are you a project person, or are you a departmental person? Tell us about that.
I used to joke that my title in all my jobs should just be get her done, right? So I take on anything that especially leadership wants taken on. If there's a hole, I try and fill it. We have a let me give you an example. Matt Abbott is phenomenal. I don't know how many of you have worked with him on the environmental front, but he's incredible. He's incredibly knowledgeable. There's no reason for me to come into this office and to start doing his work. He's great at it. So I help. I ask him what he needs. We bounce ideas off of each other. We make sure that he's getting the information that you need as a council. You know, we constantly have those balancing acts. I try and fit the hole that's needed in the moment.
And how many holes have you found?
Many.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really fun. I love it. So I'm working on Mountain Accord. A big focus for me is regional. So how do we as Park City work with our surrounding neighbors? And that's all of them. That's Wasatch County, Summit County, Salt Lake County, our resorts over the backside, our resorts here at home, our school district. I try and make sure that the relationships that we have allow for really high-functioning government. And so I work on those relationships. I work with those individuals to make sure that they're getting what they need from us and I am able to get what the city needs from them.
Okay, so speaking of regional collaboration, the Mountain Accord is probably one of the biggest, most comprehensive types of regional collaboration, even more so as we're seeing the announcement of the One Wasatch connecting all the resorts. A lot of times people start to hear about something like the Mountain Accord, and they don't really tune in until about 3 months, you know, after they start hearing about it. And then they go, gosh, I wish I would have tuned in from the beginning. Why don't you take us through what the Mountain Accord does?
Sure. So let me give you a little history. When I worked for Salt Lake County, I actually started several projects that led to the Mountain Accord. So I worked on a canyon transportation discussion. I worked on a Wasatch Canyons Tomorrow project. I worked on the wilderness legislation that Congressman Matheson introduced. So when I came up here, it made sense for me to help Park City, Summit County, and Wasatch County be major players in this discussion. What Mount Accord is it's a discussion about the economy of the Wasatch. It's about transportation in the Wasatch, recreation, and then the environmental components of the Wasatch. And it's how do we, as we grow in population size, needs, as climate change impacts our mountains and our snowpack, how do we work together to preserve what we need, but also to allow people to use the mountains, which is the reason they came here in the first place.
Using Mountain Accord as a model where you have those four working groups that are looking separately at those issues, but then tying them all together in a really comprehensive package that, you know, I think at the end people are going to be able to get their heads and arms around and embrace or disagree with, but it'll be pretty clear what's going on. And then comparing that to Park City, and you're talking about the holes that you're filling and the different issues that we have, challenges or opportunities that we have, transportation, congestion, our entry corridors, you know, how our keeping a vibrant business. We've got the goals that have been set by the community, but it's kind of like Mountain Accord. We've got these groups and departments working on these different areas. Is there a way to tie that together, or are we already doing that in the city in such a way that Mountain Accord seems to have it mapped out?
I think that this community is far more progressive, and our staff is far more progressive on that front. So not in the political progressive sense, but in the forward-thinking political sense. People talk all the time. I am in regular communication with Blake, who's the head of our public works team, and Kent, who's over transportation. We work as a team, and I have been highly impressed at the willingness of each team member to do what it takes to make a great city. It may be outside of who they are in their job title, but everybody comes to the table and they work on whatever has to be done in order to make it a great community. And I love the focus that it's not about what I do for a job. It's about what we do as a city. And I do think that they're very similar. And I think that we're really lucky. Each group goes through, they brainstorm what they think is best for this community. You then lay that together. We bring it before council. Council does a visioning session. They say, yeah, these pieces are fitting nicely. These pieces aren't. We need to tweak these in order to make it happen. And we do that discussion at least once a quarter, but if not every council session. And the council is very progressive in the sense that they think about where they want to be. And so I think we're all trying to continue to be this really cool town that we all came here to be in the first place. And we're figuring out what it takes to get that.
Okay. So speaking of what it takes to get that, one of the items in the news recently is this potential plastic bag ban. And the city's tossed around this idea for a while, but has hesitated, saying, as former Mayor Dana Williams used to always say, we like the carrot approach versus the stick approach. Well, now perhaps the time has come for the stick approach. There's been a lot of education. A lot of people already use reusable bags, but they're thinking maybe just creating an ordinance. So you in the sustainability department have studied this quite a bit. What have you found in other communities that have introduced this?
You know, it's a waste stream that nobody really wants. And I think that that's a fair statement, whether you're living here in Salt Lake or in Park City. It's a waste stream that goes into a landfill and often isn't really usable. There's not a great benefit to it. Having said that, I have forgotten my garbage bag or my grocery bag on a numerous number of occasions. And so
as we all have.
And so I think what we have found in other communities is that we would be the first in the state. That means that there may be some really hard discussions that we have to have with people who are not even within our community. We're always cautious to make sure that we're doing it in the most sound way so that if it goes to the legislature, we get to uphold it. As many of you know, the idling ordinance used to in Salt Lake City used to have more teeth when that went to the legislature because people were upset. That got stripped down to an education only. So, you know, it's constantly making sure that we're doing this in a smart way. We're bringing in partners and we're talking about it. Having said that, there is a day that a council has to sit down and say, it's time. And if the council is there, that's great. We're going to be presenting on this issue ongoing, and we're going to keep talking about this, and the council is going to keep trying to figure out if today is the right day.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people who argue an ordinance saying it is government overreach, you know, the bottom line is if everyone in the community embraced the idea of not idling their car or not bringing or not using plastic bags, then you wouldn't have to have an ordinance.
Well, I mean, you could apply that to a lot of things like speed limits in neighborhoods. You know, mm-hmm. we should all be going the speed limit in neighborhoods, and some people choose not to, and they get ticketed.
So we have a limit.
Yeah, and we have a limit, and it's a law. And it seems like as communities and government, you know, communities and government have to sort of evolve and morph over time. And I'm wondering what your thought is about sort of how we've done things here in Park City over the last recent history, say 20 years that I've lived here, 22 years in Park City, where it was almost like we had the luxury of looking at various issues as standalone issues. You know, we had affordable housing, which was standalone. We had parking structures, which were standalone to deal with traffic impacts. And congestion is sort of a standalone issue. And how are we going to deal with that? But it seems to me that there's something that's come together now, and maybe I'm mistaken about this, and I'd like your thoughts on it, that's creating a new paradigm where things are going to have to be more closely connected and even blended in the future.
Absolutely. But please know, I think those conversations really are happening today. So let me give you an example. I, in Salt Lake County, would have never met with my affordable housing person. I just never would have thought of the important component of having affordable housing close to the workforce in allowing for smart transportation. I did work a lot on bus routes and changing bus routes and assuring that bus routes were consistent so that when someone rented an apartment, because it was close to a bus route, they could get to work.
Do you look at that as kind of a missed opportunity in your in the areas you've worked in the past?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you could have a do-over.
Totally.
And take today's sensibilities and apply them to 20 years ago in Salt Lake City, would Salt Lake City look significantly different or planned than it is today?
I think so. But I'll tell you that Mayor Ralph Becker is really pretty forward-thinking. He's an urban planner. He looks at the and he's passionate about the green movement. And so he's constantly looking at those pieces as well. But up here, you know, you're really lucky. You've been talking about affordable housing as a sustainability measure for 10 years. I had never thought of it, but this team has thought of it, and they have thought and talked about how do we lay these layers on top of each other so that we get a great community, and how do we support our resorts? How do we create a really great tourist opportunity while still having a small town feel for the people who live here every day?
Final question, Anne, with transportation in your background, what do you think it'll take to get people out of cars?
You know, that's a really great question. Salt Lake City has been working on a couple of options right before I left. One was that we were going neighborhood to neighborhood trying to help people individually connect to mass transit or to walking and riding, walking them through the full process, giving them a pass to get on the bus. It's about doing it once. It's about getting comfortable with an experience so that you start to be able to integrate it into your life. That's an option. Kent Cashel, who's the director of transportation up here, is looking at all those options constantly to figure out what the best way is to get more users on his system. But you also have an incredibly well-used system up here, which is fantastic. The PC Salt Lake City Connect is something that's still relatively new, but we're trying to get numbers up there and trying to maximize people going up and down the canyon via mass transit. I think that we are we're on the right path. And I think over with the council we have right now, who's really interested in talking about transit and transportation, there's a new push and energized nature behind this discussion. And I think you're going to continue to see cool things. So I would love to see people, you know, I'd love to have a community group go out and work with neighborhoods and help families get onto the bus. I'd love to see if there are ways we can do challenges to that effect. I'd love to see if there are ways that we can, you know, if we need to tweak something here and there, tweak it so that it makes more sense.
It sounds like you're focused on the local users.
Absolutely.
Versus the tourist. The tourists have kind of figured out a bus system. The most effective users are the Sundance crowd. They're amazing on the transit system.
They are pretty fantastic, and it's because it's free. It's easy. They don't have to rent a car, and it's such a hassle to try and figure out roads in a new community. So for them, jumping on a bus in front of their hotel is super great.
And also they come from communities where many of them don't even have automobiles.
So. And you've also got some generational differences where some of the younger generations are really focused on transit or frustrated when they can't go hiking on a bus, right? Like, it's a different mentality than my generation or my parents.
I always found when I traveled and would take public transportation in cities that I felt like as long as I don't know how much less time, if it does take less time in a car, then I'm great taking the bus. And
absolutely,
that's part of the problem here is that I know it takes me 7 minutes to drive to work, where taking the bus, you know, might take 15 or 20. So
absolutely. And when we're trying to figure out really tight schedules with our kids as they're trying to get to soccer practice and trying to get to school, that those few minutes matter.
Okay. Ann Ober, thank you so much for joining us. And I know you were, your title was evolving. What does it turn out that it is?
It is Regional Community Development Director.
Okay.
And that's because so much of the work I'm doing is across the region. It's really about what's happening on both sides of our boundaries, those that we are over and those that we are partnering on.
Okay, very good. That's a long title, but
it
I have it written down in its entirety.
Thank you.
And thanks for your time today. You're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back with Spike Carlson. He's no ordinary home project guru. He may be the guru. So if you need a little inspiration towards some home projects, especially heading into spring, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
The Glitter Tent at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glitter Tent restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glitter Tent serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch, and Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from deposit accounts to business lending. We have one branch in Park City and two branches in Heber and Midway, Heber Valley Bank. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, Spike Carlson is no ordinary home project guru. He may be the home project guru. He's a former executive editor of the Family Handyman magazine. He's written hundreds of articles and has overseen the creation of dozens of books about home improvement projects. Plus, he's from Stillwater, Minnesota, and you know about those Minnesotans. They're all over the place with the home improvement projects, aren't they?
Always so, improving.
Always improving, those Minnesotans. Well, he's going to join us now to talk about his new book, The Backyard Homestead Book of Building Projects. It's just in time for Park City. Well, you could clarify this, Tim, to say it's okay to have farm animals in your backyard.
Apparently, it is.
I think I don't think there was an ordinance against it, and City Hall has recently decided it's okay to not change the ordinance as long as your farm animals aren't noisy. Well, Spike Carlson is joining us now. Maybe he can tell us all about chicken coops. Good morning to you, Spike.
Good morning. Well, I can tell you right off the bat that about two-thirds of the communities in the United States have passed some type of chicken ordinance, which makes chickening okay. They make good neighbors. They're if you're going to get into your own egg thing, they're a great way to go. And we have a couple chicken coops in the book for those who are really interested.
Well, that's great because, you know, a lot of us, I think, have these pie in the sky ideals about what we might like to do as a home project. I know chicken coops is one of them. And I just want to say you highlight these projects. You even give a list of building materials and you say how many, the length of material, everything. I love that.
It's kind of like IKEA, but a lot more understandable.
Yeah, we tried to include complete information, so there's illustrations step by step, so you can know how things go together. There's photos and illustrations of the finished projects, and the voice is my voice, and so it's kind of friendly, and it's just kind of like your friendly uncle sitting down saying, okay, here's the areas you need to be careful of, here's something you need to watch out for, here's how to do it, and if people take their time and enjoy themselves, they can build every project in the book.
But Spike, my question is, why put it in a book? Because when I want to build a project, I can go to the internet and specifically pull up all sorts of articles and directions and, a recipe for that specific project. And what I find when I open your book is I go, wow, I've got like 18 things now that I would love to do instead of just that one thing that I was going to do.
Yeah, we kept a pretty close eye on that. And, it's really a unique one, one-of-a-kind book. There's things in it that you won't find anyplace else. Some things have a special little twist to them. And like I say, we present complete information. And there's something about having, a physical book you can put down, spread out, get dirty, look at again. And so it's a great material for a book.
Spike, do you find that, what's the psychology surrounding doing home projects? I think many of us like to do them. Some of us hate to do them. Some of us are aspiring to do them but never get around to it. What's the psychology there?
Well, I think that it's a little bit like cooking, I think. You don't start out cooking some fabulous French cuisine. You start out with your grilled cheese sandwich. And it's the same with a building project. You start out with something simple, then you gain a little confidence, you gain a few more tools, you go, okay, I see how this goes together, and then you kick it up a notch. And, building stuff, it's a great family activity. You get to save some money. A lot of these projects are geared towards gardening, and, when you grow things yourself, the food tastes better. It just kind of works on all cylinders. And this book, we really focused on presenting information so people can do these things.
Spike, is there a favorite project that you have that you sort of, when you put the book together and you looked at all these projects that you compiled in the book, was there one that you said, 80% of the people that I'm targeting should do this one?
Well, I'm in love with the garden cart. And I'm mystified by wheelbarrows, even though I've used them for all my life. You've just got this tippy thing with one wheel. And the garden cart is made out of a single sheet of plywood. It uses a couple of bicycle wheels or kind of that size. It doesn't tip over. It can go over hill, over dale. It'll hold tons and tons of material. And so I just really love the garden cart. It's my favorite project. When I was test driving it, I got four of the neighbor kids in there and drove it around, and the neighbors loved it, and it's a great project.
It's funny. I have to admit, I saw that, Spike, and I thought, now, why would I build one of those when I could go to Home Depot and buy something like that?
Yeah, well, it will be less expensive, it will be better built, and you get to say you did it yourself.
And I think it would be really fun. I mean, this book is chock full of things that if you just wanted to take a really meditative Saturday and do one of these projects, you're right, you would have so much satisfaction at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think people are going to find out that they leaf through there and they go, oh, look at this storage thing. That would be great for that. Or look at this this raised bed garden. I may not want to get into gardening full tilt, but look, this is just a nice, small, containable thing I can do. Or, you know, I like to go out and harvest, you know, blueberries or mushrooms. Here's a nice little tote I can sling over my shoulder and bring with me. So I think it's not only people are looking how to do things, but it'll just kind of bring ideas to mind, too.
So, Spike, Lynn talked about the psychology of what it takes, the people that want to do projects. And I'm guessing that, you know, your audience is a interesting subset of the general population. But is there something in your book, is there a chapter or a paragraph or a sentence that will help people complete a project once they've started it? Or is that part of your audience? They're the people who start it and see it through from the beginning to the finish and then show all their neighbors their great garden cart that they built on Saturday.
Well, you know, there's a couple projects in there you can build in 2 hours, you know, and it just they take a couple boards. And one is called a Leopold bench, and it's just this, you know, it only takes a couple kinds of wood, and you can do it with a jigsaw and a cordless drill. And so the main thing is before you start a project, you just take a realistic look at it. You set aside plenty of time so you're not, you know, rushing through it. And everything is, you know, there's nothing irreversible. If you make a mistake, you cut a piece a little longer, you pull the nail. But if you get in the right mindset, you can really build the projects in this book.
And can you do your projects with a beer in one hand or a glass of wine? Is that part of the process?
That's part of the learning process, absolutely. So, you can do that with a dog to your side, with a kid to your side. It's got some great projects in there.
Wow, Spike, you just gave me an aha moment. It's so simple, yet it's obviously so complicated for someone like me who, instead of saying, I'm going to build the Leopold bench in 2 hours and allow 5 hours for it, I, 2 years ago, started a home building project that was a master bathroom, and it's still torn out.
Well, so, one thing about these projects is you get to do them outdoors. You don't need to turn off your water or your electricity, and you use them outdoors, and it's a lot less stressful on the family life.
Yeah, no kidding. And then there are also projects in here like this one I've never heard of before. This is so unusual and inventive. We like to smoke meat around our house, smoke as you're barbecuing. You have this flower pot smoker, so you slow cook meat in a clay flower pot.
Yeah, I mean, you can't do a side of beef in it, but you can do a nice brisket or you can do a nice little chicken. And it's made up of a couple of flower pots and an electric hot plate and some wood chips that you would normally use in your barbecue grill. And, you know, it's really fun. It's almost like a social event to have people come over when you do one of these. And the meat tastes great. It's kind of a low investment. And it's really a fun project to do.
I love it.
I'm just trying to envision Lynn's home, a bunch of smoked meat going on, smoke all over the place and ripped up bathrooms. That must be someplace. She needs your book, Spike.
Well, it's a great book for those who are picking up the hammer for the first time or those who have swung a hammer for a long time. There's a lot of projects for everyone.
That's right. And Spike, final question for you. What are the must-have tools around the house if you're going to do home projects?
You know, one thing people don't think about is just having a good place to store those tools, which is a tool belt or a 5-gallon bucket so that you're not running helter-skelter everywhere. And then a cordless drill is a great investment. You can use it for boring holes, for installing screws, for mixing paint. But almost everything in this book you can build with basic hand tools. You don't need any big fancy stationary equipment. You just need to have that little voice saying, go out and do it, and then you go out and do it.
Simple as that. I love it. Well, you've inspired us here today, Spike, so thank you for your time. It's been fun talking to you. It's Spike Carlson and his new book, The Backyard Homestead Book of Building Projects, 76 Useful Things You Can Build to, I'll do all kinds of things.
It's been fun talking with you guys.
All right. Thanks, Spike.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, now...
Are you inspired?
I'm inspired to call the contractor and... No, actually, you know, down the road, some friends and neighbors years ago built a little shed out back, and they made it, they really planned it through, and they planned all the building project or all the building materials, and they made it this fun family project to do. And it turned out so cute. It was a little bit of German engineering, I have to say, from my friend who wouldn't let it just be a haphazard building. And it was so cute. I've been jealous forever, and it's on page 163 of this book.
I think you should invite that family over and have them look at your bathroom.
They've been over plenty of times, and I've never let them see the bathroom. So, well, stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment with Dave Barry. Wow, is he funny. We actually spoke to him last week, and I think we cracked up all the way through the interview. We'll share that interview with you in just a moment.
The Utah Olympic Park offers winter outdoor adventure for all abilities. The guided adventure experience is a fun-filled way to build skills and enjoy outdoors as you weave through a ropes course and balance on moving features. Our experienced guides personalize the adventure for every participant. The guided adventure is available at 1 p.m. or 3 p.m. Wednesdays through Saturdays. Reservations required. Info and rates are available at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at SanFranDesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, Dave Barry is prolific in his humor and also his blogs, books, and other columns and articles. You've probably read something from Dave Barry before, or you should have. His new book is a brilliantly funny exploration of the twin mysteries of parenthood and families. He's the Pulitzer Prize winner, New York Times bestselling author of Insane City and I'll Mature When I'm Dead. So now Dave Barry has embarked on the treacherous seas of adulthood to hilarious results, like not letting his 14-year-old date until she's 40. This is the title of his new book, You Can Date When You're 40. It's full of uproarious brand new pieces, and he tackles everything from family trips to bat mitzvah parties and, again, dating and funeral instructions. He wants his eulogy to be given by William Shatner. Why not? And he's joining us to talk about his new book and other things that happen in everyday life. Dave Barry, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
So, Dave, you've done it again, whether it's any of your books or your blog. Every time I read them, I sit there and think, why didn't I think of that? It's so
simple.
Probably
because you have a job.
Right. But I think I'd forego my job if I could think of the things that you come up with. And they're so, they're sentiments that we all feel. But then you throw something else in there. There's like, with every comment, there's a twist at the end. Like going a day without thinking of a Kardashian. That is a great day.
As I say, I think. My secret is that when everybody else is doing something useful, you know, making the economy better, making the world a better place, going out and doing something productive, I'm sitting at home in front of my computer thinking of booger jokes. I think that's the difference.
Dave, have you always done that?
No, I started out, thousands of years ago as a newspaper reporter. But when I could,
but
I would
write, serious newspaper reporter?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I covered municipal meetings. I mean, some of them are probably still going on.
Oh, you
I
and mean, Lynn have that in common.
Oh, okay. Well, then what happened, Lynn? One of us went wrong, Lynn. One of us.
Well, she's kind of funny, too. I think she sits at her desk and thinks about some of the things you think about. She just doesn't write them down.
Well, and when you cover municipal meetings, sometimes, and I have to say Tim's on city council here, so he's one of those people that makes you think, either I better think of something funny or I'm going to die of boredom.
Thanks, Len. What I
finally realized from my days, I worked for a newspaper called the Daily Local News in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and I could have written, you know, midway through my, one of my, 57-inch school board stories,
I could have written a sex scene in there. I don't know that anybody ever got that far, you know. But I learned from that. Was an interesting experience because I learned that we could get terrible things wrong and nobody would ever notice. But if we left Sagittarius out of the horoscope, the phone would ring off the hook, you know. So we begin to realize maybe I should just switch over and write something that would be more entertaining.
And was it really that simple? You just decided one day to switch over because it was kind of humorous what you were doing anyway?
Well, it took a while. For years, maybe 8 or 9 years, I wrote a humor column every week, but I was supporting myself either by being a reporter or later on I had a job teaching effective writing seminars. But I didn't make a living from the humor. And then it was around 8 years, I started getting some pieces published in bigger papers. And then it happened pretty quickly in the early 80s that I realized I could switch over and become a full-time humor writer. But I didn't start out that. I was in my mid-30s, really, before I was making a living just writing humor.
Well, and since then, you've become quite prolific. How many books do you have out now?
Oh, it's a lot. 40 books or something like that. But I should stress that none of them contain useful information, and some of them have a lot of white space in them.
This one in particular, You Can Date Boys When You're 40. We sort of assume that you're referring to your daughter, Sophie, who was born in the year 2000, right?
That's correct. She's now 14. With quite a change took place in Sophie. I mean, we have to find a cure for puberty, I feel. The big adjustment for me has been boys. When I have a son, older son, you know, and when he was this age and started dating girls and everything, it didn't bother me at all. A double standard, but it didn't bother me at all. But I do not feel that way about the boys coming around our house, and it's deeply disturbing to me. What I would like to do is to have a trap, a humane trap, a boy trap, that I would put near the front door, which is because that's how they get in, the boys.
Yeah. Turns
and
out
I would bait it with something that would attract 14-year-old boys, something stupid like fireworks. And when I trapped a boy, I live in Miami. I would drive him out into the Everglades and release him in a humane manner.
I hear they find their way back. I'm told they find. Yeah, they're rare.
Well, that's why the backup plan would be a firearm. Not that I would ever shoot anybody, but I would have one.
You fired into the air 3 times and it scares them away.
I would saunter through the family room where my daughter is sitting on the exact same sofa as a boy, and I would accidentally discharge my firearm into the ceiling. So the boy would know that two things: one, that I have a firearm, and two, that I do not have total control over it.
So what does Sophie think about this? I mean, she knows you're kind of funny. She doesn't really take you too seriously. But when boys actually do come around, she probably, that's when your humor ceases to really work for her, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I try to be charming and nice to everybody. I get along with everybody. I have trouble doing that with the boys. It doesn't bother me that they're a little uncomfortable around me. Sophie's a little, I don't mind that they're nervous around me. I want them to be nervous around me, you know, and that's really not me, but that's this sort of instinct coming out.
Now, Lynn just said that when Sophie normally finds you kind of humorous, I was under the impression your children didn't find you funny at all.
Well, it depends. Like, I have been an embarrassing parent, especially in the middle school years, which is kind of the most embarrassing time. Like, some years ago when my son Rob was in middle school, I got a call from the Oscar Mayer company saying that they were bringing the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile to Miami, and they offered to let me drive it for a day because I like to get publicity. And I said I'd be glad to do that. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to pick Rob up at middle school in the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile.
Of course.
And
you
I will
did.
Never forget the moment he came out of the school, and there's all these moms in their minivans, you know, and looming up behind is a really big hot dog with a loudspeaker going, "Rob Berry, please report to the Wienermobile."
Yeah.
And you know, a 12-year-old could suffer a heart attack, he would have.
You know what that Wienermobile is, actually? It's a Dave Berry trap.
You know, there are actually 6 Wienermobiles. A lot of people don't know that.
I saw one once in real person. They're quite amazing.
Yes, it is. We lead the world in Wienermobile technology, this nation, although Iran is developing one.
I'm very envious of the fact that you got to drive one. That's really something. Every time I tried, when I tried, I was escorted off the Wienermobile.
it's also a chick magnet. I mean, you drive the Wienermobile around, and you can have whatever you want.
That works for you down there in Florida, does it, Dave?
Yeah. The supermodel, actually, it doesn't work.
And along with your children not finding you all that funny, I'm sure your wife just got a big kick out of you driving around trying to pick up chicks in the Wienermobile.
Well, we actually did drive it on South Beach, my editor and I, South Miami Beach, where there's a lot of attractive women. And we were on the loudspeaker going, "Do not fear the Wienermobile, ladies." But nobody came. Nobody was attracted.
Maybe just a hint of a grin that they were trying to suppress. Okay, so your book, you maybe even in the first line, you say, even though this seems like a book on parenting, it's really not. And then on the back cover, you talk about things that a man should know how to do. And one of those, of course, is to never wear capri pants.
Yeah, I have a whole essay on manliness, my theory being that we're not as manly as we used to be, the men of today. And so I talk about things you should and shouldn't do. And one of them you should not do is wear capri pants. And the fashion industry, the male fashion, particularly the New York Times fashion section, every 6 months, like clockwork, declares that capri pants are in for men, which is, of course, not true. Capri pants will never be in for American men, but they keep trying. And there are people who say, well, yeah, but there are countries where the men wear capri pants. And I say, yeah, but none of those countries has ever won a war.
Of course. Around here, we call capri pants shants.
Really?
Like, you shan't wear those short pants.
You hear that, Todd Aronson? And Dave, I know your greatest claim to fame is Speak Like a Pirate Day.
Yeah, I am.
And I have one word for you. Arr.
Arr. I didn't invent Talk Like a Pirate Day. It was invented by a couple of guys in Oregon, but they wrote me a letter, this was maybe 10 years ago, saying that they thought everyone should talk like a pirate on September 19th, which is, you probably have gathered, is one of their ex-wife's birthdays. And I wrote a column about it, and I didn't really think anything of it when I wrote the column, just another column. And that has become, of all the things I've ever written, probably the most influential, because now all over the world on September 19th, people talk like pirates. Long after I'm dead and gone, the only thing I'll be remembered for, if anything, is International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
And I always wondered why my daughter talked like a pirate one day a year.
That's why.
That's it. Well, Dave Barry, it's been a pleasure hearing from you for this brief bit of time here. Best of luck to you, as always, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Again, that was Dave Barry with his book, You'll Date When You're 40.
And my daughter talks like a pirate a little more often than once a year.
I've never talked like a pirate before. I like this idea.
Yeah.
Does she say more than arr?
Yeah, she does.
Shiver me timbers. Oh, I'm sure she's perfected it if she does it more than one day a year.
She has.
Well, Dave Barry, what a great guy. That was fun.
That was fun.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. We want to thank our underwriters:
Park City Clinic, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Prudential Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank, and the Park Meadows Country Club.
And, of course, you can always listen to archive programs of The Mountain Life on kpcw.org. Just go to Shows and The Mountain Life, and there they will be. They're usually uploaded sometime on Wednesday afternoon. And tune in tomorrow for Cool Science Radio, beginning at 9 a.m. We'll be speaking with Mary Roach. She's the author of the book Gulp. It's about adventures in the well, digestive tract and the alimentary canals of your body. It's really, really interesting stuff, albeit a little gross. Yeah. So I'll really look forward to that conversation with her. That's Cool Science Radio, of course. You've been listening to KPCW Park City.